Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. What a fabulous day. I try not to talk about the weather on radio, but seriously, it is an amazing day today. And I'm sitting here overlooking downtown Seattle at the high-rises, and the Olympics are popped out behind, snow-capped. It is just a beautiful day, so I hope you're enjoying it. And thank you for being with us this hour. Coming up later in today's show, we will be talking with international best-selling novelist Pam Jenoff. She's known for her historical fiction, but she really doesn't like to be labeled as a historical author. Although this one we're going to talk about today, her new book is called The Ambassador's Daughter, and it's set in Paris in 1919. And we're going to learn more about that and Pam's work in general and being a writer later in today's segment, in today's show. First, we're going to talk with somebody whose work I've been following for a long time. You know, President Dwight Eisenhower said many years ago, what counts is not necessarily the size of the dog in the fight, but the size of the fight in the dog. And Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman set out to find out the size of the fight in all of us. They wanted to know how underdogs beat the odds. So they went into this intense research to put this book together. It's called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, and it is really fascinating. Let me tell you a little bit about Ashley Merriman and Poe Bronson. Together, they wrote the bestseller Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. Additionally, they've written for Newsweek, New York, The Guardian, and many other publications. They've won 9 national awards for their reporting, including Penn Center USA Literary Award for Journalism, the American Association for the Advancement of Science for Science Journalism, an Audi from the Audio Publishers Association, and 2 Clarion Awards. And I spoke with Poe on Friday last week because they are traveling today because they're coming to Seattle. And he has authored himself 5 books, including the number 1 New York Times bestseller, What Should I Do With My Life? He's also written for Time, The Washington Post, and The Daily Beast. And although he was born and raised in Seattle, he now lives in San Francisco with his wife and 2 kids. And Ashley Merriman lives in L.A. She's an attorney. She previously served in the Clinton administration and currently volunteers as the head of a small inner-city tutoring program. Now, we had very little time together, and this is a really in-depth book, more than almost 100 pages of research notes at the back of the book. But so I wanted to focus on some of the differences that surprised the authors when they were putting this book together. And again, the book is called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, and bringing to you for the first time my interview with Poe Bronson. Poe, as the title suggests, your research for this book has thrown a whole new light on winning and losing, the science behind it. How did you get interested in this topic?
I didn't tell a lot of people, Vicki, but 3 years ago I had a hip replacement, and I had several unsuccessful surgeries, and rehab had a lot of setbacks. And I was sort of like one of many people might go through, is kind of losing some of my ability to keep leaning in and attacking this challenge in my life. It was affecting my work, affecting my volunteer projects. I was interested in getting my game back, getting my game on. And I'd always had it before, and so began to study the science of that. To me, it's you know, we call it the science of winning and losing. It's about achieving your goals. It's about competing in challenge. It's about responding to challenge. And it's really about having an eagerness to tackle the big challenges in life rather than dread of them.
And it is, I said before we started, a fascinating book. I mean, congratulations to both you and Ashley Merriman who wrote this. Incredible amount of research went into this. How long did it take you to put it together?
Well, because we have two of us, it's a three-year project, but because there's two of us, you know, it goes faster in terms of understanding and processing all of that science than one person could do alone. You know, none of our books have been the same. This is my seventh book, second with Ashley. Our last one was on the science of child development called Nurture Shock. And, you know, this is a whole new topic. There is some stuff for kids there, but, or for parents of kids, but people are like, how can you suddenly switch gears and actually try to become an expert in something? And I'm like, well, that's why there's two of us, you know, to really get up to speed on this. We attend conferences. We talk to the scholars. We get to know them very well. And we approach it a little bit different than other journalists because we're not just waiting until the work is published. We spend a lot of time at conferences where they're presenting their newest work, and we get to deal with them directly.
Right. And your research found some really significant differences between those who play to win and those who play not to lose. And it made me look differently at some of the things I do, and I'm sure it had the same effect on you. But I want to look at some of those differences you found. For example, both you and Ashley were blown away by the gender differences you found in the science. And I heard you say, and I'm paraphrasing this Poe, but I heard you say, as a son of a feminist single working mother, I'd never given gender differences much thought before, but the science was showing very significant differences there. Talk to us a little about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, the biggest difference I could point to is that we all heard that in the November 2012 election, some women were elected to Congress, which was terrific, but it's still only up to 18%. And the science is showing that when women are on the ballot, they actually do equally well as men. The question is, why aren't they on the ballot? And the stunning fact was that for that election cycle, for the entire year of 2012, out of 180 million American women, only four of them, anywhere in the United States, went to their local city attorney or city hall to fill out paperwork to run for governor. I'm not talking about only four women were in the final race, only four women ever.
Right, apply. Wow.
That's amazing. And, you know, that's sort of not a victory. For all the great things that we've had for equality, that's not a victory, and it's kind of interesting why. And historically, scholars would look at this and kind of assume, well, we don't really, it's kind of taboo to talk about. We don't popularize this science, but women seem, you know, maybe more intimidated by this, or maybe they lack that something about them competitively. And that turns out to be wrong. Amazing research by Sarah Fulton at Texas A&M. She was polling state senators, people who were already elected to the state house, who are perfectly positioned to make the jump to run for Congress. And she polled them and wanted to know what did they think their odds of winning would be if they ran for Congress, and were they likely to run? And what she found was surprising, that when the odds of winning are below 20%, all the candidates will be men. All the candidates will be men when the odds are very long. But when the odds hit 20% and begin to increase, women start jumping into the race. And in fact, when the odds get decent, you know, one-third odds or to 50-50 odds and above, women will be more competitive than men. More women will jump into the race than men will. And what turns out is that women are actually, it's not that they're not competitive, certainly that once they're in the race, they compete every bit as hard as men. They're more choosy in when they enter races because they are very good at accurately assessing the risk of losing. Men seem to be very good at ignoring the odds. Women are very good at judging the odds and don't want to waste time with losing. And this has interesting effects out there in the real world. In the high-tech culture and startup businesses, women employees are still outnumbered by men 2-1. It could be that the long odds nature of that business is affecting whether women even want to go to those companies that might fail. But on an industry like Wall Street, where judging risk accurately is really important, The science actually says that women, female financial analysts are 7.3% more accurate than male financial analysts. So you could actually have a hedge fund that, you know, bought the women and sold the men, and you would make quite a bit of money.
It would be interesting to see if Wall Street reads your book and makes some changes based on that.
You know, it's kind of interesting. So the role of a financial analyst on Wall Street is arguable. You know, we think of them as the people who are supposed to tell us exactly what is this company supposed to earn per share, you know, in each quarter, and then make those predictions and be accurate about it. Though they also serve a purpose historically of marketing companies and marketing their bank that they work for, and having overinflated recommendations is useful for drumming up a stock and drumming up business. Mm-hmm. Even though they've been separated, you know, right now, female financial analysts are only 16% of the population on Wall Street. 10 years ago, it was 20%. So it's actually going in the wrong direction, which is not a good sign.
Right. Well, you know, another interesting fact there in the differences, the gender differences, was job interviews, because men tended, you said, to be overconfident when they were talking right. about their accomplishments. And women actually downplayed and even misrepresented themselves in a negative light. How so?
Right, so women aren't necessarily, they might downplay themselves, but they, so women actually present themselves accurately, the same way that they judge risk accurately. The promises that they make to a future employer about what they can and cannot do tend to be accurate. And they do it somewhat, though, in a self-deprecating conversational style. They're careful not to be over, just show overconfidence or to brag. While men, just habitually, if you bring men and women into a laboratory and you give them a task that they've never seen before, some puzzles or math stuff, men who've never seen it before will think, well, I've never seen that before, I'll be good at it. Women say, I've never seen it before, I don't know if I'll be very good at that. If they've done it before, men come in and say, I've done that before, I'm going to be great at it. Women come in and say, I've done it before, I'll be good at it. And so men tend to have overconfidence, less awareness of the risks, and have overconfidence. And so in the same interview room, right after a woman comes in and is accurate about what she can do for a company, men might come in and promise more than they can really deliver. But it sounds great to the future employer.
Yeah, so they're actually not discriminating, you say. They're taking people at their face value there.
I don't want to say that there isn't bias and there isn't discrimination in any particular environment. There may or may not be. But this is an additive factor that needs to be understood as to why, in some situations, women are not getting hired.
Yeah. Food for thought there. And this one, Poe, this difference actually blew my mind. And if somebody on the street had told me this, I would have said, oh, that's rubbish. You talk about entrepreneurs, and you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
the sex of a person, you say, it turns out to be a distraction. It's finger length tells you far more than gender. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, finger length. So any listener out there, right now what you should be doing is holding the palm of your right hand up in the air facing you, with the palm facing you. Straighten out your fingers and look at your index finger and see how long it is, and then go two fingers to the left to your ring finger and look how long that one is. Now, again, you stay with me, listeners, but if you have a longer index finger than ring finger, that's more of a typical female pattern. And if you, but though many women are the opposite, if you have a longer ring finger than index finger, that's the typical male pattern, but one third of women have that too. And if you have a longer ring finger than index finger, by even just, you know, a millimeter or two, you know, a tiny bit, 10% longer, you're much more likely to be a risk taker, much more likely to be have the hormonal response to challenge. They see this in entrepreneurs. They see this in financial traders in the City of London. They see this in MBA graduates from the University of Chicago. And by looking at their fingers, they can predict whether MBAs are going to have careers where there's a lot of risk involved, such as high tech and high finance, or go into a safe career just from the finger length. Now, what is going on here? Why would fingers mean anything? It turns out that the same forces and factors factors in the womb when we are developing that lengthen the fingers, those same forces act on the developing limbic brain, and they alter how cell migration happens in the hypothalamus, which the hypothalamus is the initiating gland of the entire neuroendocrine cascade that happens when we respond to challenge. So finger length, therefore, is actually this marker. It's not perfect, but it's a very good marker of brain differences. And, you know, they are somewhat associated with gender, but not necessarily so. And if you want to know who's going to be an entrepreneur or take risks, you can look at their fingers more than you should be looking at, say, whether they're wearing pants or a dress.
Wow. It is fascinating stuff. And you and Ashley Merriman, Poe Bronson, you and Ashley Merriman have done a fantastic job on putting this book together. It's called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. And I could talk to you for another hour, but I know I have to let you go. So, but you will be in Seattle.
Thank you so much for the time.
You're very welcome.
I'll be in Seattle Tuesday, March 5th at Town Hall.
Super. Thank you so much, Poe. And that was Poe Bronson. We're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, I'll tell you how you can find out more about Poe and his work, and how you can get to see Ashley Merriman and Poe Bronson tomorrow right here in Seattle. You're listening to Conversations Live. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuses, no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN!
Did you know 1 in 3 adults is at risk for kidney disease? And kidney failure is more than 3 times higher in African Americans. If you have high blood pressure or diabetes, you could be the one. Visit the National Kidney Foundation at kidney.org. Now, you know.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
You're listening to the refreshingly different Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we just played to you for the first time interview with Poe Bronson, author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, that he co-authored with Ashley Merriman. And I wanted to let you know that they are coming to Seattle tomorrow, Tuesday, March 5th. They're going to be, where are they going to be, Eric? Eric's going to come on and tell us all about it.
They're going to be at Town Hall, it looks like, and that's from 7:30 to 9 o'clock tomorrow. And you'll want to enter at the 8th Avenue entrance for the Great Hall.
Very good. Thank you, Eric. And, you know, this was it really was, I can't tell you, there's really fascinating stuff in here. There's, you know, we tend to think, I don't know about you, Eric, because I know you're very creative, but people often say you can't be creative and be competitive.
I hope that's not the case.
but you know, you know that's not true because right. There are people at the top of the game and people at the bottom of the game. And sometimes the talent, you know, doesn't always qualify why somebody's at the top versus the bottom. So, you know, there's
a very competitive element in there somewhere, as well as being in the right place at the right time and trying to make things happen.
Yeah.
And they had a really interesting story in the book that they shared. They share a lot of interesting stories in the book. But this one I thought was particularly interesting because it showed the competitiveness between artists that we think of as dying for their art, you know, Da Vinci, Michelangelo, and Raphael, and mm-hmm. how very competitive they were amongst each other. So I just thought that was really interesting. And this is not a how-to book, but I think if you understand the science behind it and how the brain works and how it reacts to competition, I think it gives you a leg up there. What did you think about the successful entrepreneurs' fingers?
I thought that was intriguing. I've never heard that before, that the length of someone's fingers has more to do with whether they're successful than their gender. Is that right? That's
well,
along the lines of what they were saying?
As an entrepreneur,
right.
The successful, you're more likely to be successful mm-hmm. as an entrepreneur if your ring finger is longer than your index finger.
Interesting.
And there's a lot of science behind that. And as you said, it happens in the womb, you know, what's yeah. happening with the brain. But of course, it doesn't go to explain, you know, there are a lot of people out there with ring fingers longer than index fingers
right.
who
are
don't
just
even want to be
entrepreneurs. Yeah.
So it's all interesting stuff, I think.
Well, I think it just goes to show that, you know, the factors that we take for granted of whether someone's successful, you know, whether we're white or, you know, whether we're a male or whether, you know, how we were raised may not necessarily be the critical factors for making success down the line.
That's very true. Yeah. That's very true.
Could be something weird, like your ring finger, for instance.
And I've had length of fingers mentioned on other things before. And to be quite honest, I've always poo-pooed them. But there is solid scientific fact behind this. It's really interesting. And so one of the things I wanted to just mention is that we have a blogging online class coming up. And that's going to be coming up in April. And I have a couple of spots left. It's mostly full, but we do have a couple of spots left if you're interested in, you know, taking your blog to the next level or even starting a blog. If you're interested in finding your voice, I'll give you an idea of what we're going to be talking about. It's just going to be a 4-week course, 4 sessions. And we're going to talk about what makes compelling content for the web, because you've heard the expression content is king. A lot of the SEO rules have changed. We'll look at that some a little bit there, but it's mostly going to be about finding your voice, choosing your blogging platform, finding your niche, and using your personal experience to build an audience. So whether you want to just build a blog yourself or whether you want to build one for your business, you know, we'll cover all of those aspects and it will be very, very personalized for each individual. So if you're interested in learning more about that, you can drop me an email at info@conversationslive.net or call the 800 number, 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. All right, we're going to talk in the next segment to international best-selling author Pam Janoff, and I know she's waiting for us on the line right now. So again, just a quick reminder, you can see Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman tomorrow at the Town Hall. At what time, Eric?
That's at 7:30, and looks like tickets are only $5, so really
and that's inclusive for the other, there's another speaker on there as well, I think.
Yeah, it's a double feature with Poe Bryson and Ashley Merriman. The Science of Competition is
right.
The talk.
And then there's another feature after that, and I'm not quite sure who else is there, but they're definitely worth listening to. It's really interesting stuff. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Pam Janoff. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to In Clover, makers of Connectin, Optigest, and Glow, we cover the world of animals. This week, March 10th, Teresa and Lisa from BioClean join us in the studio, and we're in for a real education. We'll hear more about their amazing cleanup business, of course, but mostly we'll learn all about hoarding and specifically animal hoarding. Find out how incredibly prevalent the problem is, how to recognize the signs, and how to help. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Vicki's guest takes on Dr. Phil with humor and common sense. David Bedrick says there's a better way, one guided by love and deeper spiritual meaning, versus the unconscious bias of a culture prone to normalization. Will you agree with him? Tune in next Monday at noon to find out. Vicki also talks with Joe Mason to share important information on the latest scams and how to protect yourself from fraudsters. See conversationslive.net for guest information and more than 200 podcasts.
Did you know 1 in 3 adults is at risk for kidney disease? If you have high blood pressure or diabetes, you could be the one.
I was looking in the newspaper and saw an article that said if you have symptoms for kidney disease, you should see your doctor. And I really didn't expect anything because I felt healthy. I didn't worry about my borderline high blood pressure. Turns out it was silently inflicting kidney disease. When you know, it's almost too late.
Visit the National Kidney Foundation at kidney.org. Now you know.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Lewis and Clark would be proud. We're exploring new territory on the air every day right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Pam Jenoff. She's an international best-selling author. She's written several novels, including The Commandant's Girl, which received widespread acclaim, earned her a nomination for a Quill Award, and became an international bestseller. She previously served as a foreign service officer for the U.S. State Department in Europe, as the special assistant to the Secretary of the Army at the Pentagon, and as a practicing attorney, and received her Juris Doctor from the University of Pennsylvania and her master's degree in history from Cambridge University. And we're going to bring her on right now and find out more about Pam Jenoff. Her new book is called The Ambassador's Daughter. Welcome, Pam. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, I'm pleased to have you. Interesting story. I read some of this down on the beach yesterday. Shows how my Sunday morning went. I kind of got transported away. So we'll tell our listeners a little bit more about the book in a moment. But let's find a little bit more out about you. You grew up where?
I grew up just outside Philadelphia, where I am presently. But in the intervening time, I spent many years away, New York, Washington, and about 5 years in Europe as well.
I read that you kind of get torn between being a global traveler and being a homebody. So do you still feel that way?
I do. I loved my years abroad, and I'm always eager to go again, but I have 3 preschoolers, and so my wings are a bit clipped at the moment.
And you're still teaching, I read.
I am. I teach law at Rutgers University.
It's a lot to do with three preschoolers and write books. So I guess one of the questions that we want to find out is how do you manage to juggle all of that?
Oh, well, you know, when I first wanted to become a writer, I was actually a practicing attorney with a mound of student loan debt. So I used to write my novels when I first started from 5 to 7 in the morning. And that was my routine for many years. And now I have a lot more flexibility in my schedule because I'm in academia. So I just think, you know, it just somehow gets done. It's not pretty,
right.
But it gets done.
Now, you went to Cambridge University, which is very beautiful. It's a very beautiful little town. Tell us a little bit about your experience there. How old were you when you were over at Cambridge in England?
I was at Cambridge immediately after my undergraduate years, and so in my early 20s, and two of the best years of my life, doing all the things, you know, sort of the British students do with the crew and whatnot. And one of my earlier novels, Almost Home, actually is set there and involves, you know, a murder and a death years earlier. So I've delved into that part of my life in my writing as well.
Right. And at what point did you decide to go into Foreign Service?
I went into the Foreign Service not long. I actually took the Foreign Service exam when I was at Cambridge, and it takes quite a while to get into the Foreign Service, even if you're successful. And so I spent an intervening year at the Pentagon, which was a tremendous chance to see the world from the shoulders of giants. If you will. And my Foreign Service commission came up, you know, and it was after Cambridge. It was a chance to live in Europe again. And they sent me to Krakow, Poland, which was, you know, quite a unique and interesting place right after communism had ended.
And that influenced one of your other novels, right?
I'd actually say it has influenced almost all of my books in one form or another. But when I got to Poland, there were many issues from the Second World War that they simply had not been able to resolve during the communist years because the dialogue had been stifled and, you know, East and West had been largely separated. And so in the 90s, when Poland and the other Eastern European nations wanted to join NATO and the European Union, we were trying to untangle these remaining issues from the war. And I was on the ground over there, very much involved in this. So I came away from those years in Poland just profoundly moved and changed. And a lot of my writing tends to be grounded in those experiences.
Mm. So what interested you in getting into the Foreign Service? Was it just a whim, or was this a travel thing? Or tell us more.
Well, I had just come out of, two of the best years of my life in Cambridge. So I sort of, you know, I had that sort of young person's burning desire to, you know, just bounce right back overseas. And I took the Foreign Service exam in London on a whim on a Saturday morning, if you'll forgive me for saying, after a big night out of Cambridge. So it was very much on a whim. And I took it, and I somehow passed that, and I passed the next stage. So I went into the Foreign Service and the State Department sort of just kind of checking it out. And I got there, and my wonderful peer group that I started with, they all said, well, I've wanted to do this since I was 12 years old, and I took the exam three times. And so, you know, it probably explains why they're still doing it, and I've moved on to novel writing and teaching. But I do think the Foreign Service is just the finest people and the finest work you can possibly imagine.
Mm. And I read that you were a rower at Cambridge, which, of course, is huge over there because there's a river running right through the town.
Well, I got there and pretty much everybody rows, but I have to say, for truth in advertising, that I got there and I said, I want to row. And they looked at me and they said, you're too short to row. So I was actually the coxswain. So I was just,
well, I think that's the best position, right?
In the back and steers and gets no exercise out of it whatsoever.
But you get to enjoy the river and shout at everyone.
It's gorgeous.
So after you finished with the State Department, where did that take you?
I came back to the States, and I actually went to law school. I did not continue on in diplomatic service, but I knew I was going to write a novel. I'd always wanted to be a novelist, and I wanted to write a novel set during World War II and influenced by my time in Krakow. And I had never actually gotten off the ground with my dreams of novel writing. And for me, the epiphany was actually the events of 9/11. You know, I had this epiphany. I became an attorney 1 week before 9/11 happened. And when it happened, I realized that while being an attorney was a fine and admirable profession, I had this deeper dream of writing a novel, and I needed to get started. So I took a course and, you know, started in 2001 writing the book that would become Commandant's Girl, my first novel.
And you were literally getting up in the wee hours of the morning and writing before you went into law practice, right?
I was, and, you know, I was a very boring person, went to bed very early, got up and wrote. And, you know, now that I have three small children, I wish I had 5 to 7 in the morning to write. But, you know, now I just find other times.
So why did you start with your first book, The Commandant's Daughter? Because I read somewhere, I don't remember where now, but I read somewhere that you actually had another novel in your mind that you wanted to write first.
Well, I had two ideas, Commandant's Girl and Almost Home, which was actually the Cambridge novel, which had also come out of my years in Europe. And I took both to my writing class, and people said, well, go with Commandant's Girl. So I started there. But the interesting part was, as I was writing the Commandant's Girl, which is set in Krakow during the Second World War, I met a couple very well-known Holocaust survivors. And when I told them what I was writing, they said, surely you know the story of the Krakow resistance movement. And I could just come back from years of living in Krakow, never heard of the Krakow resistance movement because everyone who was a part of it had died during the war. So I went back to Poland and researched it. And that actually became the true underpinning for my first novel.
Mm. We're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk with more with Pam Jenoff. She's an international best-selling author, and her latest book is called The Ambassador's Daughter. We're going to find out more about this story, which is set in Paris in 1919. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Vicky's guest takes on Dr. Phil with humor and common sense. David Bedrick says there's a better way, one guided by love and deeper spiritual meaning versus the unconscious bias of a culture prone to normalization. Will you agree with him? Tune in next Monday at noon to find out. Vicky also talks with Joe Mason to share important information on the latest scams and how to protect yourself from fraudsters. See conversationslive.net for guest information and more than 200 podcasts.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Stay informed with news, traffic, and weather at the top of the hour, weekdays on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m.
Have you been to Paris, France? And if you doubt that Paris was made for love, give Paris one more chance. The home of Pierre Chevalier must have done something right to get passion this way. If you don't think Paris.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And in this segment, we're talking with international best-selling author Pam Jenoff. Her new novel is called The Ambassador's Daughter. Publishers Weekly says it's a breathtaking, they're talking about The Commandant's Girl, which was Pam's first book, a breathtaking debut. This is historical romance at its finest. So, Pam, let's talk a little bit about genre, because I know some people put you into the historical category, and then you wrote a different kind of book, and they were like, well, why didn't you write more history? But it all involves a certain element. So talk to us a little bit about how you'd classify yourself.
Certainly. So I've never really planned to write in a particular genre. As I said, when I started out in writing class, I had one historical and one modern, and people said, write the World War II book. So I did, and I was writing this quite serious story about set during the Holocaust, and then the reviewers started calling it historical romance. I thought, all right, you know, that's fine. It's all a question of sort of how it gets wrapped up and branded. So that worked out very, very well, and the prudent thing to do would have been to write more books just like it. But after Commandant's Girl and the sequel, Diplomat's Wife, I had this other project, the Cambridge book, Almost Home, that I just really wanted to write. And I decided that in order to be true to myself at that point, that was what I was going to write. So, you have to listen to your readers, and it's always very much on my mind. But, there's also a part of the art that just sort of dictates what comes next, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Like most people, I'm always fascinated by who influences you, what inspires you as a writer. And Anita Shreve was one of the authors you talked about, Tracy Chevalier, Pat Conroy. Why those particular authors?
Well, you you know, it's always hard in an interview question. You name a few authors, and of
sure.
course there are dozens and dozens that influence us. But I'm always interested in my own work in what I call the gray areas in people. So I'm very interested in, you know, these complex portraits that sort of poke at and defy some of our conventional historical norms about what happened in different periods of time. And I think that the best writers that I read, you know, really do that. They really put you in the shoes of a particular protagonist and face you with some tough questions and force the reader to ask, what would I have done? And that's what I aspire to do as a writer.
Right. Well, you mentioned protagonist. Your protagonist in The Ambassador's Daughter is Margot Rosenthal. She's brought to the peace conference by her father, who's a German diplomat. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Certainly. So the first thing to know about The Ambassador's Daughter is it is actually a prequel to The Commandant's Girl. It's a freestanding book, and you can read it alone, having never read the others. But for those listeners who happen to be Commandant's Girl fans, and many of people have been asking me for another book in the series for years, I decided to go back in time 20 years to the World War I era. So Margot is a young German Jewish woman at the Paris Peace Conference with her father, and she's young and naive, and she finds herself embroiled in a world of artists in Montparnasse and espionage. And she meets a young German naval officer who will later become the commandant of The Commandant's Girl.
How hard is it to write a prequel? Because if you're writing a trilogy that is moving forward, your characters can evolve as the story goes on. But with this, you've already got, you know, fairly established characters, and you're going to have to go back and talk about the events that shaped them to make them into these characters.
It was really fun. I had a lot of doubts at the beginning. You know, there's already a sequel to The Commandant's Girl, and it's called The Diplomat's Wife. And I felt if I went further and forward in time, we'd be in the 1960s, and that didn't feel terribly historical. So I thought, let's go back. And I've always been intrigued by the World War I Paris Peace Conference era. I wrote my master's thesis at Cambridge on that very time period. So I had a long-standing interest, and it was fun to go back. And I had a couple of doubts. First, I said, will readers want to follow me back to World War I? Because there's a lot of readers that focus on the Second World War. So, you know, I was pleased to find that people are really discovering the World War I era with Downton Abbey and The Paris Wife and lots of emerging literature and film. So that was exciting. And then, as you said, it's tough to write a prequel because, in some sense, you know, history, the future history is already written.
Mm-hmm.
But it was exciting. How does a man like Georg, who's, you know, later go from bright-eyed naval officer in the First World War to, you know, to enough anger and suddenly becomes a Nazi and a high-ranking Nazi, for example. So it was interesting to probe some of the backstory, and there were many twists and turns that I had never known about before writing them.
And so what went into your research? Obviously, these things are well-documented, but I know that I'm thinking of in A Hidden Affair, for example, you at one point wanted to write about Nazi gold, but a lot of authors have written about that. So you wrote about something which few people know about, which was the wine and war, the French and the Nazis battle for France's greatest treasure. So talk a little bit about how you get these nuggets of information and what you did for The Ambassador's Daughter on research.
Fun to find some bit of true history. Of course, I take many liberties because this is fiction, and weave it into the story. So as you said, in A Hidden Affair, which is the sequel to Almost Home, I'd written about wine fraud, which was really, really interesting, and the history of wine during the wars. In The Ambassador's Daughter, of course, you have this era. It's immediately after World War I, so there's lots of, you know, there's just all sorts of devastation, and at the same time, this exciting new world being born of new countries and rights for different groups and new roles for women. And my research, it really depends on the book, you know. So having lived in Europe, many places that I write about are just very intrinsic to me in terms of the feel. And then you sort of go back and dig deeper. Sometimes it involves travel. Sometimes it involves maps and old books. And I think periodicals from the era are a wonderful way to explore history and whatever sort of you can get your hands on. So for The Ambassador's Daughter, two really interesting things were, of course, studying the artists of Montparnasse and that whole era. And then the third part of The Ambassador's Daughter is after the peace conference, and it's set in Berlin in around 1920, and that's a wonderful era. My character's Jewish, and I find, you know, Margot's Jewish, and I find it really interesting. It's this little-known era of history of the Jewish population in Berlin, where they were wrestling with what their role was to be in the new society, and it's just you know, so interesting in light of what was to come.
Mm. You know, one of the things that surprised me, you know, everybody's a critic these days because of the internet. But I always look at, you know, what critics have to say of books as well as, you know, the praise that people give. And this person actually loved your book and loved all of your writing, but was talking to her readers of her critics blog and said that, I know many of you don't like when a female, in the title of a book, when a female is attached to a male, like the ambassador's daughter, the commandant's girl. But you are writing historical stuff here, and that's, you know, that's the way it was back then. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I actually, my first book, The Commandant's Girl, was very much on the forefront of this trend. And in the past 6 years since then, there's been this proliferation of books with wife and daughter and all of these titles. And so for us, when we wrote Ambassador's Daughter, in order to stay consistent with sort of the trilogy, we kept that theme. And I think there has been a backlash in the blogs about these kinds of titles, except that, number one, they're still, you know, very, very popular and do very, very well, because they are so descriptive and appropriate. And I can tell you my next book, which is going back to the Second World War, is called The Winter Guest. So it has nothing to do with a wife, a girl, or a daughter.
There you go. So tell us a little bit about Margot Rosenthal, who is the protagonist in this series.
Well, Margot is completely torn between shoulds and wants. You know, she's a lot of
as many of us are. Right.
Yes, a lot of readers have found her to be sort of naive, but I think it would be typical of a young woman of the day who's been very sheltered. But Margot has a wounded fiance back in Berlin waiting for her, who she hasn't seen, you know, in 4 years. So she's torn between her duty to him, her feelings for Georg. She's torn between wanting to find an adventurous place for herself in this new world and her obligations to her father and her family. And in trying to please everybody, she gets caught up in a lot of lies and a lot of webs that she sort of weaves for herself. And I think the novel and the growth story here is really about how to set herself free from that and make her way in the world. But it's not an easy or clear-cut trajectory that she's taking by any means, even at the end.
But that's what makes a protagonist interesting, a character interesting, isn't it?
It is. I write about a lot of people that I'm not sure everyone's going to like, and that's a little scary, but it certainly makes it more fun.
Mm. So tell us a little bit about your writing process. Everybody's very different. What do you have, rituals? Do you have or habits that, you know, drive you forward?
Yes, I would say three things. My writing process is, when I start a book with an idea or image, I let myself throw down on the computer, say, 150 pages of whatever comes out in any order, plot, dialogue, etc. And then at some point, that document becomes really unwieldy. And so then I start to organize with chapters and charts and outlines. But that's my general starting point. It takes me about a year to write a book. I don't know why I always finish around Memorial Day. I haven't quite figured that out. I take notes the night before so that I don't have to worry about writer's block in the morning. I have prompts to work from. And right before I finish a book, I go away to the beach, to some little ramshackle motel, and beat the book into submission for a weekend.
There you go. And I guess I read your editor's always telling you get the word suddenly out of there. So I guess that's what you're doing on that little retreat.
I do the seek and replace on suddenly.
So what do you like most about being a writer? What do you like least about being a writer?
Being a writer is absolutely my rock star dream. So sometimes, you know, when I get caught up in all the worries about the business side, et cetera, I have to pinch myself and realize that I'm just very, very lucky to be in this game. The absolute best thing about being a writer these days is the ability to connect with readers, not just one-sided, like here's my website, but have ongoing relationships with readers. So I urge them to find me on Facebook or Twitter or wherever they hang out, you know, or email, and just, you know, so we can have that conversation. I really do think that's the best part. I don't think there's a worse part. Sometimes when you're in the middle of writing a book, it's sort of this dark, swampy middle, and you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. But given that it's the beginning of March and I'll finish a book around Memorial Day, I'm in a better place than that right now.
Right, right. So I read that your motto is to succeed, you have to put your muscle behind your passion. Talk to us a little bit about how you do that.
I would say two things. The first is that I've been in writers' workshops, you know, over the course of the past 10 years many times, and I've seen a lot of writers that were, frankly, more talented than myself as writers, but it's just kind of about the discipline and the tenacity, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning and the not giving up, I think really separates, you know, making it and, you know, getting published, if you will. So I think that's what I meant when I said that quite a long time ago. And then you just kind of have to, you know, pay yourself first and make sure you're carving out the time for writing. Anne Lamott said in an interview once that before children, she couldn't write if there were dirty dishes in the sink, and after children, she could write if there was a corpse in the sink. And that's my favorite quote these days, because I just think you get it done.
Who was it who said that?
Anne Lamott.
Anne Lamott. I missed that bit.
my favorite quote.
That's a good one. So after you've finished a book, do you celebrate? I've talked with a lot of authors who say, you know, they feel as though they've given birth and they want to go do something. Is it an anticlimax for you, or do you feel relieved and ready to move on to the next thing?
Well, mostly I'm nervous until I hear back from my editor. So there's that phase. But I don't have some sort of, you know, big reward. Usually the next project is coming. For example, I'm going to finish this book Memorial Day, and then we just announced today that there are 10 authors of World War II fiction, all women, who are doing an anthology together of short stories. And I'm going to be one of those. So as soon as I get done a book, I will work on that. You know, there's always something. But it's, you know, my everyday life is just really, really joyous. And so with all this stuff, and so I just kind of keep going.
Right. So do you have a next book in mind?
I do. The book I am finishing writing right now is the one I mentioned. It's at least for now, called The Winter Guest. And it is set during World War II in the mountains of Poland. Twin sisters who are caring for their younger siblings, they're orphaned. And one of the twins finds a downed American paratrooper in the woods. And so it's about his survival and their survival and kind of the tension that creates.
Mm. And you've addressed the tension between cultures in a couple of your books before. You know, anti-German feeling and in Poland, for example. Talk to us a little bit about why you felt it was important to include that.
Well, for me, you know, I went to Poland as a diplomat when I was younger, and I had some preconceived notions about what had happened during the war and all of that. And my notions were very much challenged by a sort of, nothing was monolithic. You know, there was lots going on there. And so I feel that all my books reflect that I want to challenge some stereotypes and assumptions and write about things. Sometimes it makes people uncomfortable and sometimes it makes people angry. I can certainly get my share of angry emails, but it's good for the conversation, I think.
I would agree with you. Anything that makes people think, you know, stop and think, because we tend not to. We're so busy today. So final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Pam. What do you want them to know about your work, where they can find you?
Well, I would love to hear from readers, even if they haven't read any of my work, but just want to respond to this conversation. So I have a website, which is www.pamgenoff.com, but it's also easy, I know, for many people to find me on Facebook or Twitter. I'm there, and I respond to everything, so I'd love to chat.
Awesome. And a final word to every time we do this kind of show, I get questions from listeners, but what advice you give to other writers?
Assuming they're aspiring writers, I would say three things. Be disciplined, find your equivalent to 5 to 7 in the morning. Be tenacious, because my book didn't sell for a really, really, really long time. And then don't quit your day job, obviously, because it's a long road. I still haven't quit my day job. And then the ability to revise, just taking other people who you value and trust, taking their feedback and being able to incorporate it in your own work is also a very valuable skill for writers.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much, Pam, for being with us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And again, you can find out more about Pam at her website. Pam, was it Pam? Was it PamJenoff.com?
Pam Jenoff.
Yeah, PamJenoff.com. And Jenoff is J-E-N-O-F-F. And her latest book, The Ambassador's Daughter. Well, I want to thank you for being with us today, spending this hour with us. And you can find out more about us and upcoming guests. And gosh, we've got hundreds of podcasts up on the website right now. So you can find out more about us at conversationslive.net. You can reach me at info@conversationslive.net or at our 800 number, which is 495-7617, 800-495-7617. Love to hear from you if you have feedback on today's show or questions about upcoming shows. And we will be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Thanks for being with us on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.